the Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs to order. It is Wednesday, May 30th, 2007. And colleagues, we are going to roll over to Thursday at 4:30, Shannon. 4:30, House Bill 3501. Negotiations are still going on at this point, so we will not be hearing 3501. And we are having a meeting tomorrow at 4:30, members. So I know that Senator Cruz's daughter is having her senior banquet, and that takes priority over this, so he's definitely excused. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on 2946. And colleagues, I'd like to actually open a work session on 2946 because this is a bill we've already passed, and then we brought it back into committee because we were going to add an amendment to it. Well, the amendment would have put a fiscal on it, so we decided we were not going to put the amendment in. So I would just entertain a motion to get it back onto the floor. Shannon, do you want to just explain a little bit about what it is?
Sure. I was kind of looking out for Representative Maurer as well, who I think wanted to speak a little bit to it again.
Oh, okay.
House Bill 2946 directs the Department of Human Services to seek approval from the Center for Medicaid and Medicare and Medicaid Services to operate a demonstration project to test alternative health care delivery systems through one or more pilot programs.
And colleagues, I don't want to hold it up, Representative Maurer would basically just explain about the CHAMP study that would feature a new focus on medical assistance providing routine services, particularly prevention, and the hope would be to result in a more rational and cost-effective allocation of healthcare expertise. So if there's no other discussion, I think
Madam Chair, the amendment was dealing with ALS, and which is laudable, but we don't want to bog this thing down with fiscal, and so I support just moving it back to the floor.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Are you ready for a motion?
Yes, I am.
I move House Bill 2946 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves House Bill 2946 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And who was carrying it? Senator Cruz would like to carry that bill. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2946. And yes, Representative Maurer, it's back to the floor. All right. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2927. Shannon.
House Bill 2927 establishes a 9-member task force on non-transplantable anatomical gift donation appointed by the governor, specifies the task force membership, and instructs the task force to consider specific issues related to anatomical gift donations and report the findings and recommendations for legislation to the appropriate interim legislative committee.
All right, and we, Representative Cannon, we were looking at possibly trying to make it so that it wasn't an executive duty, but a legislative duty, and we will send it to Ways and Means. Is that what you've done?
That's right, Madam Chair. For the record, Ben Cannon, State Representative, District 46. We have, you should have now, -3 amendments we just received this morning that do resolve the inconsistency that was in the engrossed bill. So these now require, if you adopt the -3, the Speaker and the Senate President will appoint the members of the board. It will continue to be staffed by legislative administration. My ask of you is that you pass this down to Ways and Means, and then it gets sort of combined, you know, looked at together with all the other task forces that are that we're sending to Ways and Means for staffing by legislative administration. The Speaker and the Senate President and the co-chairs and the Ways and Means folks can decide how to proceed with those. I understand there may be some interest in really moving some of those subjects over to interim committees rather than setting up special task forces to deal with these. That would be fine, but I think the appropriate thing, at least what I believe to be the appropriate thing to do now, is just get this to Ways and Means so it can kind of sit there with the at least 3 other bills that are also staffed by legislative proposed staffing by legislative administration.
I would recommend too. I think we had some talk regarding that they felt that there were organizations that would be volunteering or helping with the staffing, and if a letter maybe could be attached with this bill when it goes to Ways and Means so that they know that, and that might help the decision process in Ways and Means.
Absolutely. I think that's okay. A great suggestion, Madam Chair. I also want to draw to your attention the Dash 2 amendments, which I did not draft. I think Representative Greenlick asked to be drafted, and I am fully in support of those. Those simply allow the public health officer to be replaced with the designee of the public health officer. So I suggest you adopt those that amendment as well.
Thank you. Any questions?
That makes sense.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Gurley.
I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2927.
Senator Gurley moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2927. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2927.
Senator Gurley moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2927. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2927 as amended to Ways and Means.
And can we do that at this point? Okay. Senator Gurley moves House Bill 2927 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. Any discussion? Any opposition? It's done.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I will close the work session on House Bill 2927, and I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2733, and Representative Greenlight, perfect timing.
Thank you very much, Senator Atkinson. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2733. And let me tell you a little story. Just a few years ago, the Providence Health System had in place a data security system that included putting 300,000 patient records into the trunk of a car and taking it home at night. That was the official data security position of Providence. The inevitable thing happened that somebody broke into the car and took a briefcase that they believed probably contained a computer and sold 300 and so thousand personal health care records. Could have been your records, could have been my records. We had been seen in that system at any time. The official response of the CEO was, oh my goodness, somebody in our organization really screwed up. And we're going to find out who did it and we're going to punish him. My immediate reaction to that was that the person that screwed up was the CEO, because the CEO did not know what data security systems were in place, had obviously not approved them, because I would think any rational CEO would not approve a data security system that including putting 300,000 patient records in the trunk of a car and taking it home every night as a way of dealing with data security. So I propose House Bill 2733, which is a relatively simple bill on data security. And it's a bill that simply says the CEO of healthcare systems or health insurance companies need to know what their data security system is, need to review it, and need to certify that they have put in place a data security system that they think is state-of-the-art and will basically do the job. It also has some pieces that has them attesting that if there are breaches to the data security system, they will have shared those breaches with their board of directors, not with the state, not with the newspapers, but with their own board of directors. Now, you've passed Senate Bill 583. And the interesting thing about Senate Bill 583 is it, for some reason, in Section 12, excludes the hospitals and the health systems from the data security measures that are put in place in other parts of 583. It doesn't exclude the hospitals and the health plans from their requirement to inform patients about this, but it does exclude them in Section 12 from the other data security parts of 583 on the assumption that HIPAA compliance assures that the data security systems will be in place. Well, of course, when Providence lost its 300,000 records, HIPAA was in place. When the VA lost several hundred thousand records, HIPAA was in place. So essentially 583 in its current form, in the form as it's in Ways and Means, simply says hospital and health data aren't as important as, say, your financial data, where the financial institutions and other institutions need to assure the data security of their data. It assumes HIPAA does the job. Well, of course, HIPAA, you have all the evidence you need that HIPAA doesn't do its job. So what I'm urging you to do is to pass 2733 as a complement to 583, which is an important bill that does a lot of important things, but does not do what 2733 does. We also, incidentally, support the -5 amendments to 2733 that you have in front of you. Those are amendments that the Insurance Division has asked to be put in place to make sure that the reporting lines are correct. But basically, if you're interested in protecting patient data security information, which we all are, we work very hard to do the kind of things, I really request that you seriously consider 2733 as a complement to 583 and not a thing that's made unnecessary because of the passage of 583, and I urge you to amend 2733 with the -5 amendments, move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It's passed out of the House overwhelmingly. I don't remember what the vote was, but overwhelmingly out of the House, and I would urge you to add this piece to assure that the millions of our records as patients, and we're all patients in the healthcare system, that our records are maintained in a secure and safe way, and we can feel confident about that.
When was HIPAA implemented? I remember it was, I think, in the 90s, correct?
Well, it was passed in the late 90s. It was probably implemented right after the turn of the century in its full-blown form. I think
Okay, so I guess the point I want to make is it's fairly recent, and it was really something that should have been probably done years and years ago. Okay.
Well, HIPAA doesn't deal with the data security component, so HIPAA simply deals with issues of how you can disclose data and what are the conditions under which that data is disclosed.
Great. Question? Yes.
No, I'm just going to agree. I mean, HIPAA started to be implemented at turn of the century and has been an evolving process as Congress has tried to get their hands around something that was implemented by executive order. So it's had a very interesting history, and it's still evolving. So.
Any other questions? Okay, I'll call Joe Ario and Dave Fiskum. Might as well. The last two, those are the only two that have signed up for this. And you can stay there if you
All
want
right.
to.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ario, Administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We support the testimony that Representative Greenlich has just given as to the need for House Bill 2733 and have the amendment as our principal interest here, which would make the reporting on the insurance side simpler. Under the bill as passed by the House, there are two different sections of the insurance code amended. One of them has to do with certified audits, and we think that this report doesn't belong in the certified audit category. If you look at the language of that section, that speaks directly to the financial solvency of the company. There is another section that's also amended, and that's the section that deals with annual reports by insurance companies, and our amendment simply deletes references to these reports in that first section about certified audits and puts the responsibility clearly in the annual report section of the statute. So it's really a simplification of the reporting on the insurance side, and so we'd urge support for the Dash 5 amendments. Be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Dave Fiskum.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, Dave Fiskum here representing Providence Health System to make some comments on House Bill 2733 along the lines of what I shared with the House committee chaired by Representative Greenlich, and which I thought I might have the privilege of sharing with you as well with the representative's comments. It would be okay if I did so. And at the risk of appearing to disagree with my friend to my right, I want to say that Providence believes that House Bill 2733 is, in fact, not necessary for one very important reason, the existence of Senate Bill 583, which stands as a major consensus product on ID theft policies and procedures and which has been passed by the Senate Commerce Committee. The bill is awaiting action, ways and means, and my sense, as a prediction, is that bill will pass before this session adjourns with our support and with the support of many others. For several months last year, as you may know, several of us, as many as 30 people, participated in a work group under the leadership of Senator Floyd Prezansky in the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which produced a bill that requires records safeguards and sets up public reporting standards in the unfortunate case of a theft of records or breach of records. I appear before you today as a representative of an organization, Providence Health Plan, that encountered a major theft last year, as you know, and as Representative Greenlich has described. We believe that in the unfortunate situation that happened, we responded very affirmatively and aggressively to that theft and, in fact, took, at a very high level within our organization, personal responsibility for dealing with the implications of the theft, which was attributed to an individual who violated our procedures by taking a laptop home. Records were on it. We have since, of course, as you might imagine, reviewed our procedures from top to bottom. And obviously, in a situation such as we experienced, the lessons are learned, and we learned lessons. This is not a lesson, but armed, motivated by our experience, the unfortunate experience, we did contribute very genuinely and consistently to the Senate Bill 583 process. Representative Greenlich has mentioned concerns about 583 with regard to exceptions or exemptions relative to HIPAA. Madam Chair, what I have provided, what I will provide to you for the record, and I'm happy to give it to your staff as I'm trying to speak, if she's on the phone, obviously. I indicated to you that in the House consideration of this issue, we had dealt with the issue of what 583 requires and what HIPAA requires. My friends at Regents did a side-by-side summary of side-by-side summary of what 583 requires and what 2733 requires, and I will leave that with you. I don't intend to read it to you. In an attempt to indicate that what happened in the 583 process was not an exemption or an exception from a stringent set of record-keeping requirements, but rather an attempt to avoid duplication, given what HIPAA, in fact, does require in that detail provided in that summary, that crosswalk, as Regents described. Back to House Bill 2733 for just a moment. In Sections 2 and 3, the bill places requirements on insurers, one of whom I represent, the Providence Health Plan. Section 4, the bill repeats generally those reporting requirements for health care facilities, including hospital systems, one of which I represent, Providence Health System. We understand, as Representative Greenlick has described to me on several occasions this session, that the major import of House Bill 2733 is to require top executives in healthcare enterprises to attest to the fact that, as he might put it, they have record-keeping systems and, in fact, attest to the viability of those systems. Let me emphasize, our concerns do not rest with that requirement. We take responsibility for records retention, records protection, and respond to records at a very high level, the top level of our organization. Rather, the details that are required, such as those outlined on page 2, section 2, lines 25 to 40, and similarly on page 3, section 3, lines 35 through the top two lines on page 4, could present troublesome issues for us. We are to prepare and sign reports detailing apparent deficiencies in records protection systems and steps we take to deal with those deficiencies. Logical things to do. It's what we might do anyway as good managers of healthcare enterprises. And on one hand, we hope the leaders of two state agencies, the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research, would be careful not to produce forms for signature that would end up creating, unintentionally perhaps, difficult public details, since the records are, in fact, once submitted to state government, public records. We are concerned about the level of detail that could be required. Let me stop there, Madam Chair, except to say that along the way in this process for the last number of months, Providence has been labeled at one point in the news media a poster child for data theft because of the occurrence in Portland last year. We believe, genuinely so, that we have gone on since the theft to earn a reputation as a poster child, in fact, for our response to theft, and it is, in fact, in that spirit that we suggest to you that Senate Bill 583 is a good vehicle, worthy of your support, and that House Bill 2733 is not a necessary addition to that. Should it pass, we'll live with it. So I'm not here to enunciate a shrill opposition to the bill introduced by my friend Representative Greenlick, as much as to say that genuinely our position is we think it's not necessary. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to try to answer questions.
In this bill, will there be outside auditors versus inside auditors? Tell me how the audit of basically in Section 2.
Madam Chair, your reference is?
On the safeguards, lines 25.
Madam Chair, I guess I don't know, frankly,
the
answer to your question.
Well, actually, lines 28 and 29. Contain assurances that the signing officers have disclosed to auditors and the governing board of the covered entity. So those auditors, are those auditors that you would have anyway, or do you have auditors inside the system?
Madam Chair, my presumption is probably both. The context strikes me as those are internal auditors, the kinds of persons that we would engage anyway to analyze our procedures and attest to their adequacy, to identify deficiencies and to respond to those deficiencies, and the governing board would be, in the case of Providence Health System, we have a governing board. It happens to be a multiple state governing board, and we have then advisory boards at each state where we operate. So the context there leads me to believe that those are internal auditors as opposed to, for example, auditors from state government. Mm-hmm. But there may be somebody in the room from DCBS or the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research who would be a better person to answer that question than I.
Okay.
Question.
Yes, Senator Carter.
Mr. Fiscom, you're very good. And let me just say to you, you know how to keep your friends and your enemies both at bay. I love it. But in terms of 530, all significant deficiencies in the design or operation of record-keeping systems or controls that could adversely affect the covered entity's ability to protect the confidentiality of individually identifiable health information. Are you saying to this committee today that controls, and design of the operation is sufficient to take care of lines 30 through 32 within the system of Providence and already, and other systems, not just Providence.
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I appreciate the question. Our concern is not with the words there relative to the identification of significant deficiencies in what we're doing, as well as attempts to deal with those deficiencies and rectify them. That's not the issue. The issue is...
Let me reframe my question.
What has to be disclosed publicly is the,
right.
the question.
And see, this didn't happen within the public domain, except it was carried into the domain. What this line is asking you in the representative's bill is, can you assure this committee that operationally this is being done within the confines of the hospital so that data is protected within the system to the degree that we won't have to worry about, again, someone taking their laptop home and exposing all of us that have membership in a data system as we know it today is being protected?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, as I indicated at a high level in the organization I represent, we're prepared to attest to the viability, the adequacy of our record systems. Should add to you that in no case can anybody in this world, including the person who runs Providence Health System, avoid human error.
I agree.
Human error occurs, unfortunately. That kind of situation happens. It's unfortunate. It's potentially devastating. It requires a very affirmative response. And in our, we believe we responded very affirmatively to a substantial set of records which were in some jeopardy. It took us, genuinely so, 3 weeks to be ready to provide enough information to as many of those who wanted to know as 365,000 individual records. And we responded very affirmatively, and we made everything public, and we took responsibility for it, and have spent a lot of money to attempt to rectify the internal failures. We are prepared to identify deficiencies, as any good manager would, and prepared to deal with those deficiencies and rectify them to the extent we can. Is there a guarantee? No. We are prepared to sign such a document if that's what it takes. We have some uneasiness with regard to the detail that might be required. If we need to live with that and deal with that and deal with that when it comes, we are. The councils who represent Providence Health System, the legal councils, have expressed concern to me on two accounts. One, the creation of public records that could provide information unwittingly and unknowingly and unintentionally to hackers, as well as identification of material that could be subject in some form or shape or context to legal discovery. Those are issues of concern to us. Is the issue signing off at the top that this matters to us and this is an important issue? No. Is the issue the detail? Yes.
Madam Chair, can I comment on that?
Hey, Mr. Fiskin is a very good lobbyist, so I'm assuming he isn't choosing specifically to misread some lines, but let me read some lines to you. The issues he's worried about, ABC, on page 2, line 30 through 38, follow something that says the report needs to contain assurances that the signing officers have disclosed to auditors and the governing board of the covered entity those issues, not to the public and not in this report. The same is true on line 39. Contain assurance that the signing officers have identified for auditors and any material weaknesses in the record-keeping system. That's to auditors. On page 3, where line 35. Contain assurances that the signing officers have disclosed to the board of directors of the facility. Again, any significant. This is not all the reports do, all the public reports do, is assure the public that the management has reported any of these deficiencies or breaches to their own board and their own auditors. Now, an attorney might ask, would that report be discoverable in a lawsuit? And the answer is yes, maybe it would be discoverable in a lawsuit. But
But this bill does not require any public disclosure of those things. It's only assurances that the management is doing their job. And I absolutely believe that if 2733 had been in place 2 years before that breach of records, that would not have happened. Somebody would have looked at the data security systems and said these systems are not adequate and we need to do something about it. I believe it would have saved Providence from themselves, and that it might save other organizations from themselves by assuring they're doing their job. This is very much the same as we're doing on the national level and requiring corporate officers to sign the financial statements. So you don't have a Kenway saying, ooh, look at all these odd things that happened in my company. We'll find somebody and we'll take care of them. I didn't know anything about it. That won't happen again on the financial side. And the only purpose of this bill is to try and prevent this from happening in our very personal medical data from organizations that should be doing this anyway. And all we're asking is that they certify that they're managing properly in this area.
Yeah, the further, yes, Senator Gordley.
Yeah, just a clarifying question, please. I'm still not clear on why and how hospitals were excluded from Section 12 of Senate Bill 583. Did hospitals, specifically Providence in this case, did Providence actively seek an exclusion from the bill and that section?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the answer to your question is that in the course of, I believe, if my memory serves, 13 work group sessions, though others in back of me may know how many there were at DCBS leading up to this session, the healthcare interests were represented both by myself on behalf of Providence for not all, but many of those, as well as the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And at one point in those deliberations, under the leadership of Senator Prezansky, it was suggested by the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems that it would make sense not to subject healthcare facilities to duplicate requirements to the extent that HIPAA already did what it does on that summary. So the quick answer to your question is yes. Healthcare interests asserted an interest in not avoiding the implications of 583, but avoiding duplicate requirements, and in many other cases beyond the issues covered in that side-by-side that we prepared for you, hospitals, healthcare facilities are in fact subject to the regime built in Senate Bill 583, especially with regard to public notice provisions when their theft has occurred, the timing of such provisions, how such public notice is made, of a whole host of issues that were at least one focus of those deliberations. But yes, healthcare interests did assert an interest in avoiding duplicate requirements given what we believe to be the strength of HIPAA.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my concern at this point, because I do think HIPAA covers a large amount of ground, and also looking at the very fine work Senator Prezansky has done over basically a four-year period on consumer protection and identity protection and information protection, and he needs to be applauded for an incredibly comprehensive body of work that's in 583. And I guess what bothers me is, because I think the protections are in place either in 583 or in HIPAA, and what bothers me is after we've had this incredibly comprehensive piece of work, then we have this one other little thing coming along beside it. And whether it's relevant or not, or whether it's valuable or not, and the intention is, and I understand that, but when we have such a comprehensive piece of legislation, it needs to be allowed to work without continuing to tinker with it before it's been fully vetted. And that's just a concern I have.
Okay. All right. Dr. Janine Smith.
Madam Chair, let me just add one quick mm-hmm. final comment, if I might, for the record. I've seen the Dash 5 amendments Mr. Arroyo presented, and Province Health System is fine with that clarification, as he suggested. And let me just conclude as I leave the microphone that my main objective today was to put these thoughts on the record. If you choose to pass the bill, we will live with it. We'll make, in the spirit of these comments, we will implement it. We will sign executive attestations to the fact that our records are in place. It's a priority for us. It's important for us to make these comments to the record, however, and thank you for that chance.
Senator Mona Sanderson and the committee. I'm Dr. Janine Smith, the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, and I have just a brief overview of comparison of HIPAA versus this bill. One of my staff had the pleasure of reading HIPAA yesterday for hours, and we found that a lot of the what is contained in House Bill 2733 is in HIPAA security rule. However, we did find a study on a national group called the Healthcare Information and Management Systems Society that 22% of healthcare providers remain out of compliance with HIPAA's privacy and 44% with HIPAA's security. So House Bill 2733 strengthens HIPAA by adding accountability at the state level by requiring signed assurances that any material weaknesses in the facilities, record-keeping systems, or controls have been reported to their board of directors. So we don't feel that requiring this attestation adds any additional burden to our office because we already collect the hospital financials that are signed by similar CEOs, so that attesting that they have discussed their security measures with their operations is just an additional piece of paper in our perspective. And with that.
All right, colleagues. Senate Bill 583 was a huge amount of work, many work groups, and it's going to cost the insurers. It'll be a costly implementation. 583 will be a costly implementation for our insurers, and so. I feel that what Representative Greenlake has proposed is extremely important, but my sense is, after talking with members of the Senate, that we should let 583 go through, work out the kinks there, and then work on this during the interim. Or actually come back, not even work on it in the interim, come back and then tighten up what may be omissions in what we have now. So I need to know where the committee is on that.
Madam Chair,
mm-hmm.
I would just say, just based on the last testimony that we heard, which was very pointed and indicating that this measure would strengthen these efforts, I would say let's move the bill. I think we need the bill as a complement to 583.
Madam Chair, in listening to DCBS report, it just makes sense to me that would happen. But on the other hand, I just didn't want to see a duplicativeness of what was happening with 583 and 2733, but 2733 makes all the sense in the world to me, that even though, according to Mr. Fiscom, that they're doing these things and it wouldn't cost them any extra heartache to have this bill, it just makes sense to me to have 2733 as a complement to what is happening with 583.
Well, you know, you play the game well, Representative Greenlake, because you're staying in the room. but I'm an old geezer. I've been out a long time. We failed on identity theft last session. We failed. We went up that hill, lost a lot of people. casualty rate was terrible. We couldn't get there. And I remember it so very, very well. And we committed in the interim, no matter what, we were going to come into this session and we were going to make it happen. And I had my doubts, because while everybody wanted to do something about it, it's one of those deals that we have in this process. Everybody says we got to do something, we just can't get there. And darn if we didn't get there. At least I think we got there. And it wasn't easy. And I'm nervous about messing with that effort right now. I'm just going to be frank with you. So that's where I am. I'm inclined to say leave it alone. With all due respect to Representative Greenlick, I didn't want to hear that. But it wasn't fun. That was a major failure for the last session of the Oregon Legislature, and I was part of it. We couldn't get there. And I couldn't understand. I don't understand this day why we couldn't get there, because it wasn't a Democrat-Republican thing, I don't think. But we got there, this session, at least. So I'm nervous about tinkering with it. So that's my position on it. As good as this guy is, and as good as he sounds, and in fact, he's still in the room, I just got to say that. So, where I am.
Can I ask another question?
Yes.
What were those percentages again? I'm going to call the witness back.
Dr. Smith. Senator Gordley and Chair Mona Sanderson, it's on the bottom of your handout, but last summer the survey was done, and 22% of healthcare providers remained out of compliance with the HIPAA privacy aspects and 44% with the HIPAA security aspects.
I appreciate you coming back to say that again. Those percentages really persuade me, and I'm just going to say this to all of us. I hope that those percentages would persuade all of us to see this as a measure that would strengthen the public policy that is probably going to go forward in Senate Bill 583. I think we need this piece.
Yes,
well, Madam Chair, one of the problems with HIPAA is it's been very expensive to implement. I mean, very expensive to implement, both for the state and for the private sector. And I would suggest when we're looking at those who are still out of compliance, it's probably more a matter of fiscal means as well as anything else. In coming up to it, we knew when HIPAA came along that it was going to take a good period of time to get everybody up to the level that HIPAA required. We knew that. And I guess I would suggest at this point in time that statistics, I'm not going to look at the glass as being half empty. I'm going to look at it as being half full, as we have come a long way towards meeting the goals. And quite honestly, this legislation doesn't deal with HIPAA, and I think HIPAA compliance gets us a long way to where we need to be. And I think we should have some faith that the system is getting there and we'll get there.
Okay. All right, I am going to, I could carry this over. We're not going to go into work session today, because there are other members of the Senate that feel that this bill is not necessary. And so at this point in time, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2733. But let's just carry it over for next time until I can get a count in the Senate. All right, with that, I'll close the public hearing on 2733, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3009. And colleagues, we thought that we could come up with a great, great amendment, but boy, it did not come out great at all. And so we're not going to entertain the Dash 5 amendments. Basically, we really wanted the Veterans Home to succeed, but we wanted to make sure that some of the issues were addressed. So what I'd like to do is, does Representative Crummell want to come up and...
I'm assuming, Madam Chair, we're still going to consider the Dash 4 amendment.
Yes, we will definitely. And then Rick and Elizabeth Peters, if you'd come up. Okay. And again, I extend my apologies for the last committee meeting, where it just was an oversight that we didn't have you testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I'll be very brief about 3009, because I'd really like you to hear from the Peters. For the record, State Representative Jerry Cremel, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over Gaston. 3009 was brought to me by the Peters, who have a vision for a veterans home and a veterans center. And of course, because they live in Wilsonville, and I live in Wilsonville, we'd of course love to see it in Wilsonville, but that, and there's property and that sort of thing. One of the things, though, that we did discover in going through the process with this bill is that the word war appears on line 16 and on line 17. And in looking at that, that would indicate that the center or the veterans home would only be open to veterans who had actually served in a declared conflict. So what we are asking in the Dash 4 amendments, and I would ask you to support, is to delete the word war, so that any veteran, whether they served in a time of conflict or not, would be qualified to be able to receive care through the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and through not only the existing home, but any future veterans homes that are built. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions, but like I said, I'd rather, instead of hearing from me, I'd really rather you hear from the Peters. And if you'd like, I can stay for any questions, or if you if it doesn't matter, I'll exit and go back to Waste.
We know where to find you if we need you.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
Mr.
you,
Chair.
Representative.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to come before you this morning. My name is Rick Peters. My wife Elizabeth and I are here, as we've been working on for the better part of 2 years in putting together and facilitating an advisory committee for the purpose and formation of an Oregon Veterans Center in the South Metro area of Portland. This represents a credible group of individuals at the director level above, including members of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, veterans groups themselves, and community and business leaders. We're working to assist with the vision and planning for a site on the I-5 corridor just south of Portland, which can house an array of services for veterans. The center would include outpatient health services, mental health, job placement, technical training, physical rehab, a skilled nursing home, which is about, of course, what 3009 is about, assisted living, sports and recreation facilities, and much more. The committee shares this vision to offer a central location for several groups to combine resources and to optimize public and private dollars for the care of veterans and become a focal site for gatherings of veterans around the state. So our vision is not only to provide care for our veterans, but also to encourage, inspire, and motivate. This is a completely different model than what exists anywhere in the nation. And what's exciting about this is that when we have, for instance, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, who would like to build satellite offices encompassing veterans benefits processing, physical rehab, mental health care, veterans benefit services, in addition to support of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs in seeing the Oregon Veterans Center exist, along with members of the general community, what we have now is a viable entity that can catch flame. No longer is it just a place to park mom and dad in a nursing facility. I should know that my mom has stage 3 Alzheimer's, the final stage. She's been in that for 3 years, or excuse me, 1 year. My father is unable to care for her, but nevertheless they're maintaining care in their own home. What we'd like to do is, for those that are able, is to simply provide ongoing help for these men and women who have served, but also to allow those people to interact with members of the community. And this is what we found to be of great support from our veterans groups and the U.S. Department and Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. They would like to see this type of facility built to honor our men and women. Now, our mission, then, is not only to provide care, but to encourage, inspire, and motivate. And a skilled nursing facility would be an important part of a much larger vision. This Oregon Veterans Home, as an example, is a cooperative venture presently between the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs and the states, whereby the VA provides funds to help build the home and then pays a portion of the cost for veterans eligible for VA care. It's important to note that no state dollars would be needed for an Oregon Veterans Home. Currently, you may have heard the numbers from previous testimony, there are 119 state veterans homes. Idaho and Washington have 3, Oklahoma has 6, Missouri and Colorado has 7. However, Oregon is 12th in ranking in veterans per capita, has one state veterans home currently located in the Dalles, 151-bed facility. We understand that at present, the current needs just to bring Oregon up to par, we would need more than 800 skilled nursing beds in the state of Oregon. So at present, we have less than 20% usage in terms of demand. Both the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs confirm that half of the more than 360,000 veterans that reside in Oregon live within the Tri-County area. What we'd like to see, of course, with our center is that the most effective way to meet the needs of our aging veterans is to site a home near the largest number of veterans and their families. One of the great advantages of this bill is to also allow the spouses of veterans to reside. We believe very strongly in that. The foundation believes there is a valuable synergy that will occur by having a multiple range of services for veterans and public education at one central, easily accessed location. We call this a one-stop center. This dynamic center of activity involves veterans engaging and teaching others, becoming a vibrant part of their community. We envision bringing the community to the veterans on campus through classrooms, community groups, and individuals to learn history from those who have actually made it. Living History Day every day, giving veterans a continued mission to carry on the preservation of our freedom by educating others. We have 51 acres of land available in the Wilsonville area for an Oregon Veterans Center. The city of Wilsonville is interested. We have enthusiastic support from members of Congress and the business and veterans communities. The center will move forward without this piece of legislation. However, we are here today to ask your support in sending a strong message of support for a second veterans home to meet the great need within our state. Regardless of where the second veterans home is located, we support the effort and that the bill, as amended in Dash 4, we would hope the governor will invite members of the Oregon Veterans Foundation and other volunteers working on behalf of veterans to serve on any subsequent, perhaps, task forces that might need to be summoned. Thank you for your leadership as we work to serve the men and women who have given of themselves for our freedom. We are indebted to our veterans. Neither my wife nor I have served. However, we believe it is our duty to assist in caring for their needs, and it's our honor to help preserve the liberty they have earned for us. It is extraordinary to see the public and private parties work together for such a worthy cause. The men and women of our armed forces deserve our best. May we be worthy of their sacrifice.
Would this be considered a nursing home?
It would be a state-skilled nursing facility, much like the one that's currently in the Dalles.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you have comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Elizabeth Peters. I just want to point out what's in our written testimony. What we provided is an executive summary of the center, as well as a full page of the impacts that such a center would have on veterans and their families in that Tri-County area. And then, finally, in your packet, we've provided the letters of support from members of our advisory committee so that you can see this truly has support from many, many facets of the community, both public and private. And I just want to reiterate what my husband and I have found as we've walked down this path with our advisory committee over the last 2 years, is that there is a tremendous need for cooperation between the private groups and the public groups. And that's what we're finding as we're walking down this path of forming this veteran center. For those who truly lay down their lives for us, we need to lay down our lives for them. And that's why we're doing what we're doing. And we do hope that there is some type of mechanism for responsible siting of the next Oregon Veterans Home. Well, again, as Rick said, we don't require this bill to move forward, but we do hope for your support in a second Oregon Veterans Home and in responsible siting of that home. Thank you.
Finally, I'd just like to thank Representative Krimmel and Chief of Staff Don Phillips for their extraordinary help and encouragement in getting this through. We're not exactly professional lobbyists. We both work elsewhere for a living. It's certainly not convenient for us to be here, but they have been just instrumental, wonderful to work with, and it's a pleasure to have them as our representative and Chief of Staff. Thank you.
Stay there. I want just to cover some of the concerns that had been brought up. And as you know, nursing homes, we have had a moratorium on nursing homes in the state of Oregon for years because it's very, nursing homes, it's extremely expensive. That is the most expensive way of caring for our elderly and are in the homes. And we are, the costs are very low, and I can't remember the figures. When you compare the state of Oregon, it's like 20% or 30% versus 60% or 70% in the other, on the East Coast. Most of their elderly are in nursing homes. Extremely expensive, and that's one of the reasons why their Medicare reimbursement rates are so high, is because of all of the nursing homes they have on the East Coast. So we have been really on the cutting edge on making sure that we take care of our elderly here, and also not to have all of these nursing homes pop up and then have to go under. So I just want, for the record, we have this amendment, but I want, these are the things that we truly want to have some concern, to have some forethought in deciding where to site a home. We really need to know whether there's a sufficient number of veterans that reside or have convenient access to any proposed veterans home. And at this point in time, 40% of those who live in the Dalles veterans home are actually from Portland. So will that, I would hate to have this new home take those residents from the Dalles home. So that's another part of what the thinking process has to go through before you site a home. Is it really going to then make the one in the Dalles go under, which we definitely would not want to have happen. Also, depending on where it's located, like if you would choose Roseburg, we'd want to make sure that there's a sufficient number of registered nurses and licensed practical nurses wherever it would be. This is part of what happens in the certificate of need process. And then whether there would be let's see, those are the two main things. Let me think. So do you have any comments on those particular issues?
Madam Chair, it's actually, we're very much in favor of the responsible siting. We understood there might have been some additional amendments that had been worked on through DHS or the Oregon Healthcare Association. We look forward to working very closely with them and making sure that the next veterans home is, in fact, though it may waive the requirement of the certificate of need, we certainly are very much in favor of the responsible siting. We've come to understand that of the 180 30,000 veterans that are in the Tri-County area, even if one in 100 were to reside at a new veterans home, which would be an extraordinarily low number, especially allowing spouses of the veterans to come in. It's our understanding it's going to have little to no impact whatsoever on a facility in the Dalles. We know that the experts, through their studies at DHS or Oregon Healthcare Association, would certainly be able to help analyze that information, so we'd love to be a part of that. We're very much in support of that.
Well, we would love to have a good relationship between the Department of Human Services and the Veterans Administration and the veterans, and I know I've talked to some of the veterans out in the hallway, and they smiled when I said that. So anyway, I know that Anthony Marks from the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans would like to testify. Any questions for this?
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your work. Thank you.
It's our honor. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anthony Marks. I'm the president of Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America. I'm pleased to testify before you again. I cannot reiterate the importance of this bill and the amendment. By removing the word war, opens up a huge door for all veterans. When we go into the military and we serve this country, we do not choose a war or non-war periods of time. That is determined by the powers to be. We serve the country because we feel it's our duty. And because of that, we have a code of ethics and morality that we serve this country. We put our lives on the line. We don't choose when we do that. So by removing the word war, it also opens up the availability to those other veterans that served in conflicts that were not recognized as a full war. It's a terminology era that we don't really like as a veteran. The issue of location keeps coming up over and over again before this committee and other committees before you. The availability of skilled nursing, nurses to serve in those sites. There are thousands and thousands of skilled nurses, RNs, not just in Oregon, California. They move to the location to wherever there is a job that is going to meet their need in employment. So my concern isn't so much, are we going to have enough skilled nurses in that area to operate in a facility? My concern is that we allow this to go forward to get these homes out there for our veterans in the areas where they're needed. That study will be done within the Department of Veterans Affairs. I have no doubt, just like we did the very first one. The idea is not just the site of what's going to be taken away. The issue is now is allowing a spouse to be with that other individual. That is very, very important to us. So what this is doing is making it more appealing in the Veterans Committee, our community, for a family couple who's been together for 40 years to still stay together, receive that quality of care. I'll also allow the funds to come from the federal government to cover costs. I urge that this committee pass on this so we can proceed with this. We don't want to lose another session. I remember back a long time ago when we tried to do a second home, and we lost it because it got bogged down because of location. I do not want to see that happen again because there are veterans who need this now, and to wait another session, those veterans may never get the opportunity to live in one.
It's extremely important, I think. First of all, we have a critical nursing shortage, and we have nursing homes and right now as well as hospitals that are just definitely have a nursing home shortage, including, a workforce shortage, as well as our certified nursing assistants. So that will always be a problem, I think, in the state, no matter where it will be. But it's really important, I feel, that when you site a home, it's important for, and I'm glad to hear the Peters say that agree with this, that the veterans, the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Department of Human Services, as well as the Department of Justice with expertise in Oregon and federal law, really come together, because we truly need to assess and evaluate the costs. We need to know the benefits, the opportunities, the barriers, the impacts associated with the development and the siting, as well as the construction and the operation, and the management, and then the maintenance of this second home. And so I needed to get that on the record, because we need to know if there's a sufficient number of veterans in the area, wherever it's located, because we want wherever the second veteran home is going to be put, that it is going to succeed and it will not be a burden, and that we only, if you have a 20-bed facility, it is only at 50%. We really need to have an 80 to 85% occupancy level, because we truly want, I know with the Dalles Veterans Home, it took 7 years. It's now breaking even now, but it took 7 years to get up to full capacity. And if we can avoid some of those problems that was associated with the first home, I think that would be wonderful. So, any other comments?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd just like to say that we seem to be focused on a second veterans home as if once we have it, we're done, and I clearly believe we are not.
No.
And this just makes for a better track of getting there, and there are a lot of factors to be considered. You mentioned Roseburg. I would also throw White City into the mix, because they have VA facilities, and having a veterans home in proximity to a full VA hospital makes a great deal of sense. So, but these are all factors that will be brought into play. We just need to kind of clear the path a little bit so that we can proceed. And that's what this bill would do.
Okay. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 3009. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3009.
Madam Chair, I'm moving House Bill
3009-4. Yes.
Madam Chair, I move the -4 amendments to House Bill 3009.
Senator Gordley moves the -4 amendments to House Bill 3009. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
And Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3009 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves House Bill 3009 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered, and I'll carry the bill. And we'll close our work session on House Bill 3009. And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2918. And I see Representative Edwards. Please come forward. And I think that if you can find... There are contacted, because we're waiting for, we'd like Representative Gelser and Representative Buckley to be here.
And the sixes are...
Okay.
What are you going to do?
Let's see.
Lori, what are you going to do?
Let's see. This one...
Are the sixes the amendments you wanted?
We may have to carry it over. People aren't...
We don't have the right amendments yet.
I don't know. Okay. Why don't you describe the bill?
House Bill 2918A specifies that health benefit plans may not deny benefits to an individual who is covered under the plan due to the diagnosis of a pervasive development disorder. It specifies that the treatment of a pervasive development disorder is subject to the same requirements of the plan that applies to physical illness, including copayments, coinsurance, or deductibles.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, South Jackson County. Thank you very much for your time and consideration of House Bill 2918. This bill comes to this committee after a unanimous vote from the House Health Committee and a unanimous vote on the House floor. And I believe I can summarize the reason for that support from the House. The chair of the House committee, Representative Greenlick, put it best when he said that the state of Oregon is facing a tsunami in terms of the number of children who are diagnosed on the autism spectrum. And my colleagues here can speak directly to this. I just want to give a brief overview of what the bill does. We have to address this issue. One out of every six kids in our state is diagnosed on the autism spectrum. This is having a tremendous impact on families. It's having a tremendous impact on our education programs as well. What we're doing with this bill is to try and take a step forward. We're trying to take a step forward to make sure that children that are diagnosed with a pervasive developmental disorder receive basic care at a level that their siblings would have in terms of their ability to engage in speech therapy, physical therapy that might assist them as they are moving forward in their lives. And the second part of the bill is also extremely important. It brings together the Department of Education with the Department of Human Services and at the highest levels with the Health Services Commission to come up with what's our plan going to be in terms of addressing this tsunami that we're facing in our state. And I appreciate your time and consideration of this bill. It's a very important step forward, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues to brief you a little bit more on the details.
Thank you, Chairman Sanderson and members of the committee. First, I wanted to thank you very much for scheduling this.
I said one in six, I meant one in 98. Not quite one in six.
Wow.
Yeah, one in 98. But we are the highest with New Jersey, the highest in the country in terms of.
Okay, thank you, Representative Buckley. So, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Gelser. I'm a state representative from House District 16, which is in Corvallis. For the record, there are many families that care very much about this bill, and I ask the advocates not to ask them to come because I know that your time is short. But I don't want you to think that the lack of a lot of families sitting in this room, I don't want that to give you the sense that they don't care. This is the kind of bill that gets tears in the eyes of families because they see this as one of the best opportunities they've had to access needed services for their kids in many, many years. The portion of the bill that I wanted to focus on is the insurance part of the bill, and I know that there have been questions, and I really wanted to thank especially John Powell for his help and Dave Fiskum in developing the amendments that are before you today and the Dash A6 amendments. The intention of this bill is to ensure that kids who have disabilities can have access to the medical care they need, whether that's physical health care, to study the gut issues or treat gut issues that are related to autism, or rehabilitation services that might be needed by a child with a more general developmental disorder or developmental delay. If you can imagine for a minute that you have a child that you care very much about, your son or your daughter, they're six, and you know that they need physical therapy or occupational therapy in order to improve their independence. For example, to be able to learn how to brush their own teeth or be able to dress themselves every day so that you don't have to do that for them for the rest of their lives. And you know that occupational therapy can help them to do that. And you know that if you needed occupational therapy, your insurance would cover that. Or if your other children needed occupational therapy, your insurance would cover that. But you look in your book and it says occupational therapy services are excluded for your child with a developmental disability, autism, mental retardation. That is the reality for families today who are raising children with disabilities. They see these needed services that are covered under their health plans for everybody else in their families, but they have difficulty accessing these services for these particular children. I've met with some folks in the insurance industry who have pointed out there's exception processes. You can write appeals and you can go through a process to overturn and appeal that. That's very, very difficult for these families, many of whom are up all night. Sometimes they're sectioning their children. They're evicting them. They have a lot going on in their lives, and you shouldn't be forcing them to go through a very lengthy and complicated administrative process in order to access medically necessary services that are covered under their insurance plan for everyone else in their families. The amendment that you have before you today defines rehabilitation services as those services which are needed to improve, maintain, or restore function of the individual child. There is some question about the use of the word maintain, and I wanted to explain to you why that word is included and why it's defined very narrowly just to apply to this population of children with disabilities under the age of 18. I'd like you to picture for a moment a child with severe cerebral palsy that uses a wheelchair. He might have a severe hypertonia, which means the muscle tone in his body is very, very tight. He may need to see a physical therapist once a month who can oversee a physical therapy program that the parent is implementing. But they need to check in with that physical therapist for that child's safety because the child is growing every month. That physical therapy isn't going to make that child be able to walk. But what it's going to be able to do is help that child not further deteriorate so that he develops contractures that make his body kind of fold in upon himself. Some of you may have cared for elderly parents who've had these issues. You need these range of motion issues. What this does is prevent the future need for more complicated medical equipment, for further surgeries, for heel cord lengthening, and other kinds of things. Maintain is also important for this population of kids because improvement for them does not happen at the same clip as for a typically developing child. We want that word there so that there's not a big truck that you can drive a hole through medically necessary for this population of kids. The goal here really is to make sure that these kids get access to the services that they need within the limits of the insurance plan. If the insurance plan limits the number of rehabilitation visits to 20 visits in a year for other members of the family, it would also be limited to 20 visits per year for this member of the family. This bill passed out of our House Healthcare Committee. We discussed the issue of insurance mandates. One of the members on our committee indicated this is not an insurance mandate, it's an issue of fairness, that it's, you know, kind of right on the edges, but that we really do need to provide these services. This language here just further fleshes out and makes clear what the intent was, but understanding the intent, this bill passed unanimously off the floor of the House because I think that people were convinced that it's very important to provide these important medically necessary services to these children. One other concern that was raised and that I wanted to point out to you on page 2 is the definition of pervasive developmental disorder is not intended to apply to coverage required under ORS.
Of the amendment.
ORS 743.556. And that's there to make clear that this bill is about physical health. It's not about mental health. This isn't going to open up holes in the Mental Health Parity Act. This is just about physical health, about medically necessary services that are prescribed by a physician under the limits of the insurance plan. Colleagues, I hope that you will carefully consider this bill. I hope very much that you'll adopt this amendment. This is a ray of hope to a lot of families in this state that are struggling to get their kids what they need to be as independent as they possibly can. It is a sad fact that we have about 400 children in Oregon that go into foster care every year because their parents can't access the services they need, even though they have private insurance, because these services are available to children who are covered on the Oregon Health Plan. We have other families who intentionally choose not to get married or who get divorced so that their family income levels can drop so they can be eligible for the Oregon Health Plan because they can't get these services under their private insurance. This is a way to fix that, to help people be more independent, to create some fairness, and to make sure that kids are getting what they need within the limits of that plan. And I thank you for considering the bill.
Let's have Representative Edwards and then people have some questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm state representative from House District 14, representing West Eugene, Santa Clara, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador. I'm here today as an advocate for this bill, strongly supporting it, and as a parent. I'm not a medical expert. I'm not an insurance expert. I'm not a developmental disabilities expert, but I am expert in being the parent of a child with autism. And just so you know a little bit about what it means for, and this is a picture of my son, and this is what makes this bill really relevant to me. Doesn't really look like there's anything different about Simon, does it? But he processes the world differently than you or I might, and there's no question that that manifests itself in a lot of physical abnormalities, for lack of a better word. What it means to have a son with autism is that he's very routine oriented. And if we've told him we're going to do this, and then we're going to do this, and then we're going to do this, and we don't do that, we've got issues. It means that going to the grocery store is not a simple little task, because he doesn't like being constrained. He doesn't like staying next to the cart. And it's not just a matter of just traditional discipline techniques. What it means is that he is just now learning how to get dressed on his own. If you get the shirt over his head, he can handle the rest, but he can't get the shirt over his head because he doesn't have the muscle tone in his hands. He can't brush his teeth on his own. My wife and I would brush his teeth every morning and night, and we work on baby steps, trying to get him to be able to grasp that little toothbrush and run it back and forth in his mouth. So there are a lot of physical issues that come along with some of the mental issues with autism, and things like occupational therapy really do help. And you know, here in Oregon, we lead the nation. We have the dubious distinction of leading the nation in rates of autism with 1 in 98. I mistakenly misspoke a couple weeks ago when I was testifying on this bill that Wayne County was ground zero. Come to find out, Wayne County is second to Marion County in the state, with having the highest rates, and the highest rates anywhere in the country, with the exception of Silicon Valley. The consequences of this explosion in the rates of autism are higher divorce rates among parents. It's a huge cost driver in special education, which is a huge cost driver, as we all know, in the cost of delivering education in this state. If those kids come into adulthood, it's going to be lost economic productivity and increased reliance on social services. So I think it's very important that we start addressing this, not just in the educational system, which is currently how the state has chosen to address autism. We simply leave it to the educational system, but we start implementing things like physical therapy and other treatments that we know produce higher outcomes. And I believe that it is incumbent on us, those of you that'll have a chance to vote on this bill, those of us that have been advocating for it, to really push that discussion, because unlike a lot of issues that move through this building, the constituency here is huge. Each of you has hundreds of constituents that are affected by this, but I'll tell you, they don't belong to an organization, they don't pay dues into an organization that comes to the Capitol lobby on their behalf. They're not a for-profit entity that can afford to have a lobbyist here working on their behalf. It's up to us to represent our constituents. And so I believe that the cause has been underrepresented in the building, but with the explosion in rates of autism, it is not one that can any longer be ignored, and that's why, besides the part the Representative Gelser talked to about the bill, I'm also excited about the part that directs the Health Services Commission and to get together with DHS and Department of Education and come up with a holistic plan from 30,000 feet about, you know, how are we going to deal with this across agencies, and what is that comprehensive strategy moving forward? So I thank you for your indulgence and for your time and your consideration of this bill.
I have several questions. One on the definition of a pervasive developmental disorder. So I'm sure there are a lot of other disorders, but cerebral palsy, then, a person with cerebral palsy would not be covered under this. Is that correct? Because it says a pervasive developmental disorder means, on lines 12, 13, and 14, means Asperger's syndrome, autism, developmental delay, developmental disability, or mental retardation?
That is, Madam Chair, that is my understanding.
Okay.
That includes.
It does not include.
Correct.
It does not include. Okay. Then the other question is, have we talked with PEB? Because I'm not sure their benefit covers this, and it would be nice to know if there is an economic impact on PEB, because if there was, this is going to need to go to Ways and Means. So we need to have that clarified, and I'm not sure anyone, yeah, Dr. Smith. So we'll need to, that was a question I had. Also, the word maintain in the amendment, maintain, is that an expanded, would that be an expanded benefit in the PEB program as well as an expanded benefit in OHP? So is this providing a service that would have impacts on the Oregon Health Plan? You know, so those are just little, all of a sudden, I was lying in bed last night thinking, oh dear, what if this has a fiscal impact to Medicaid as well, Oregon Health Plan as well as PEB?
Senator Mona Sanderson and committee chairs, I'm Janine Smith, Administrator, Office of Health Policy and Research, and I also sit on the PEB board and have had discussions with Gene Thorne about the bill, particularly interested in the, you know, Health Resources Commission's work at trying to look at this. And our recent renewal for this upcoming insurance year, we started to look at this, and we had some testimony from the public, and we realized it's just a huge thing that we really wanted to know. And with the PEB mission of value-based purchasing, we wanted the evidence to know what to do with about our PEB benefit. There is a benefit for occupational therapy, speech therapy for anyone under, say, Regents, and then it's up to the plans to define, you know, what's medically necessary. And as Representative Gelser pointed out, this just allows them to use the same benefit that's already there that we're already purchasing for them. It's not additional benefits on top of what's already in the plan. So if there's 20 speech therapy visits, then they would to use it if they had autism, just like they would if they had a stroke. I mean, it's similar perspective. On the Oregon Health Plan, our staff staffs the Health Services Commission, which does the prioritized list, and there is coverage for autism on speech and those kind of physical therapy based on what line it falls, and it's all covered up to, you know, as medically necessary. So I don't think anyone's really analyzed it in detail about the maintain part, but the essence of Representative Gelser's amendment was to make sure that people could use the benefits and not be saying because you have autism and you're over the age of six, you can't use your benefit that you already have.
So you're not sure regarding whether we maintain, provide benefits to maintain a condition, a disorder?
I haven't specifically spoken with Darren, who oversees the list in terms of maintain, but my understanding is that if it's not above the line and it fits with the, you know, the pairs, and so I think it's probably fine with maintain. I just hadn't seen this amendment until just a few minutes ago. So
I just want to make sure that we're and Representative Gelser, cerebral palsy would not be covered under this.
Madam Chair, it may be if they're being denied because they have a developmental disability. If their cerebral palsy is part of a developmental disability, the word developmental disability is in the bill. It's developmental disability, developmental delay, mental retardation, autism, pervasive developmental disorder.
Okay. And then we were talking about maintain, and my concern after talking with you actually last night was maintaining, is this going to impact PEB and change the services that they provide to their clients? Or is this going to be an expanded benefit then to them? Because then that has a fiscal impact.
Madam Chair, if I may, I think that what you have two protections that are there. That the goal of the word maintain, to use a very crude language, the goal isn't to have kind of denial therapy where a doctor sends a family to a doctor so they can do therapy so that they feel like they're doing something if it's not going to make a difference. The word maintain is to better describe this population of kids so that a company can't say we're denying insurance because if we give speech therapy to this dyspraxic child with Down syndrome, she will still have Down syndrome when the treatment is over. However, her dyspraxia may improve. The goal of maintain is to avoid kind of having a big hole that a truck could drive through to say that it's not medically necessary to provide services to kids with disabilities. There are two protections that are in there. One, it has to be medically necessary. It must be prescribed by a doctor. The second is that it's subject to all of the limitations that are currently in the plan. So if there are a limit of 20 visits per year for all rehabilitation services in the plan, that limitation is still there. It does not increase the number of visits that are available to a child through the course of a year. I think another way to look at the word maintain would be to look at a lack of deterioration and, again, the cost effectiveness. If you're providing a service to a kid, take that take again a child with any disability that's having some physical therapy to prevent, for example, loose joints. My son, for example, has this problem. He has a developmental disability and he has very loose joints, so that his shoulder actually falls out of joint, and so he needs an exercise program so that his shoulder isn't dislocating several times a day. There's this much of a gap between the ball of his shoulder and where it connects in.
So how often would you need to have a physical therapist come in to maintain that it's being taken care of? And the same question to Representative Edwards, if he's working on speech therapy, then how often it would be according to the plan? So if you...
Madam Chair, it would be according to the plan, and the way that I would use that benefit for my son would be to probably go in once a month or once every 2 months so that that physical therapist was overseeing the program that we were doing at home with our child. But because children grow very quickly and their bodies change very quickly, even when children are disabled, it's very important to have that oversight from a medical professional. So you're not talking about going in every day. If you don't provide that, then what happens is the child deteriorates, and then you have to go back and start all over again, which really isn't very, very cost effective. You end up with the same number of visits ultimately, but you're making the child lose function before you provide the service again to get them back to where they were previously.
And I agree. I think that's the key is that medically necessary part that the physician prescribes under the limitations of the plan. So it's This bill, were it to pass, does not say that whether it's the PEB program or private insurance has to pay on outside of the limitations of their plan for speech therapy or occupational therapy above and beyond what the limitations of their plan that would apply to all instances that they would pay for that in. And so, I think that there are the protections that Representative Gelser put into the bill that essentially put sideboards on what this legislation ends up covering.
I would like to have I would like to know if this is going to impact PEB, if we can get that.
Senator Mose Anderson, again, I don't believe it does, but I will double-check back
it's
with
just with
Jean.
The word maintain. Okay. I think that's because I think restore and improve would be covered, right?
Yes. Madam Chair, I would hope that restore and improve, and I'm speaking for myself personally right here, even just having restore or improve would be a tremendous benefit to these families who currently cannot access these services. And I would be very sad to see this very important bill die over questions of that word. So I think that that word is extremely important to this population of kids, but if it's a choice between no bill and maintain, I would rather have
the bill. And the other question, expanded benefit, is this really going to be an expanded benefit compared to what the Oregon Health Plan receives now? And again, with the wording of the amendment, if you can take a look at that.
Again, Senator Mose Anderson, I don't believe it does. There are a lot of aspects of the commissioners on the Health Services Commission have tried to maintain function as part of their analysis of where they prioritize things, but I will get reassess that with the director.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
All right, yeah. Okay.
I just said structural thing to the amendment, and just because I'm slightly confused. In the amendment on line 2, it says insert and then inserts the rest of line 2 through line 19. Above that, it deletes in the bill line 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. But then when you get down to lines 14 through 19 in the amendment, I'm not sure that they fit well with lines 12 through 14 in the bill. I think there's some language issues there. I just wanted to bring that to
just so everyone knows, I'm going to carry this over until tomorrow. We have a meeting, we're going to... it's not dead yet.
There's some duplication of words. I just think it's messy, and I don't think it... something needs to be deleted or changed in the bill to match the amendment.
I think it's very important. Anyway, can you do that? And then I want to call Mike Dewey and Jerry Connolly up because we need to be on the floor in about 8 minutes, and we will continue this public hearing tomorrow. And we have 2 or 3 bills.
Yes.
We have 3 bills for tomorrow at 4:30.
Yes.
Including this one.
Madam Chair, while we're switching seats, I just would like to thank the representatives for bringing the issue forward. It's an issue about fairness, and it's also about eliminating discrimination in access. It's very clear to me. Thank you for your work on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the ODS companies. I want to thank you for allowing us to speak. Mr. Connolly couldn't be here tomorrow, so we do appreciate it. Mr. Connolly is the manager of health care services for ODS. This is an emotional issue, and we have tremendous empathy for the families that have the disorders we've talked about. We do have some concerns about the word maintain, and we'll talk a little bit about that. This is a public policy for you. We think we are a resource, and we want to provide that information to you. So I'll ask Mr. Connolly to speak to the amendment. Restore and improve is not a problem for us, but we do have some issues, and we think it would be good to get on the record the concern about maintain. So I do appreciate your time.
Thank you. Jerry Connolly, ODS Health Plan and ODS Companies, and I want to comment just briefly on 3 points, and the first is this definition of rehabilitation services and including maintenance or maintain in that definition. I can also describe, if you're interested, how we administer cases such as this and maybe speak a little bit to the potential costs. First, rehabilitation services are commonly defined as services that are designed to restore or improve functionality, and not including the word maintain. The proposed amendment to 2918, of course, inserts the word maintain in there, and that makes this a better, more enhanced, and different benefit than the benefit that all others would receive.
How, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Can you say more about
the benefit for maintenance therapy is not a benefit that exists for any other members of our plan, regardless of age or diagnosis or disability or lack of disability. The outpatient rehabilitation services benefit is specifically to restore and improve functionality. So the addition that would change the benefit would be adding maintenance therapy to maintain functionality rather than restore or improve functionality.
Question? Yes.
and I truly understand, in terms of the parameters of cost, and I know it's off, I'm asking a question that's kind of asking you to go just off the top of your head. When you talk about maintenance, are you concerned about the numbers of time? There's no criteria, no sideboards around it. Costs can go up as a result of not having,
First of all, some of the plans we administer don't have numerical limits on visits. Many do. We administer lots of different kinds of plans for commercial insurance and self-funded plans, but they don't always have a numerical limit on number of visits. I asked our underwriting and actuarial department for cost information on this, and they were not able to give me any. We have no claims history on paying for maintenance therapy, and they couldn't find any claims history or claims data of health plans in Oregon or in other states that pay claims for maintenance therapy. And I think providers and physicians and rehabilitation therapists throughout Oregon, this is well known, and they don't submit those claims. So even if that were to change, it's impossible to measure what claims aren't being submitted now.
Yes.
So if, in the words of Ms. Gelser, in order to have this bill, maintain was taken out, would that still be problematic for the OD companies?
If the word maintain was removed, that would remove our objection, yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, that would create the same benefit for people with these disorders as people without these disorders have.
And I think there has been, in some way, between all of us, some miscommunication as to what is provided with children that have these disorders. And it's not that they are denied coverage. They have coverage. It's just what does the policy speak to? So they do have coverage. It's not that they're going to be denied because they have these disorders. No, I just wanted to make that clear.
Okay. Will this expand then the services by getting rid of the word maintain, but to restore and improve functionality, that will still be then an expanded benefit that they do, that children do not receive now?
Not for the health plan I work for. I don't know that that's true for all the others.
Okay. In other words, the dilemma we run into is we have different ways of interpreting maintain, and I appreciate Representative Gelser's and the others in terms of trying to get to something that they're trying to get something clear. Here it isn't for us. We don't use this word. It's going to be interpreted differently by different entities, doctors, and the like, and that's our concern. I use somewhat of the analogy of chiropractic care and palliative. It makes you feel better, but it doesn't get you better. And this is the area that is confusing to us, and that's why we have restore and improve in our contracts.
Okay. We need to get to the floor.
One quick question.
Yes.
Thank you. Is it the case that currently health benefit plans do not deny benefits to an individual who is covered under a plan due to the diagnosis of pervasive developmental disorder? Is it the case currently that these benefit plans do not deny benefits?
The plan I work for does not. The way we're trying to administer our standard plans is consistent with this as it's written if we remove the word maintain. I think it clarifies an issue that needs clarification. I think it makes us more accountable to do what we intend to do, and I welcome that. But if we remove the word maintain, then we're providing the same benefit to all people.
What I'm trying to establish here, I want to understand if denial of benefits, how much of an issue is that?
How often does it happen?
No. Is it an issue?
How often does it happen?
What we're trying to get at, if somebody has this disorder, would they be denied the benefit? If the doctor says it's medically necessary, they would not be denied the benefits under the plan, speech therapy and the like.
No. Most of our standard plans, and they do differ, but the most common one we administer would have a benefit of 30 outpatient rehab visits, a benefit limit, or 60 if it involves a head or spinal injury. We would pay claims for the first 30 visits, and then we would request medical record and review it before we paid on the 31st. We'd review it to see whether there was, in fact, a head or spinal injury, in which case there's 60 visits available. We would review it to see if progress is being made. And if no progress has been made and it's maintenance therapy only, then we would start paying claims at that point. We would also review at that point for the possibility of cost-effectiveness services, which is an opportunity for us to create a benefit to avoid what we think are likely to be other greater expenses. Here we're just motivated by filthy lucre, and if we think it's possible to pay for 20 more outpatient visits instead of a surgery, then we will do that, and it gives us an opportunity to intervene there and do that. That's not an appeal process. That's not a grievance process. That's simply us reviewing the medical record and seeing if there is that opportunity, usually at the request of the provider, but sometimes on our own initiative.
We're going to continue this. I know that Catherine White and Dr. Smith were signed up, but we're going to continue this bill on
tomorrow.
And if we can make sure that we have clarity on the PEB and OHP, and if this is an expanded benefit compared to what we give in OHP, that'd be very, very helpful.
Right, the amendment.
And then Representative Gelser, we want an amendment. Has anyone talked about a sunset? Is that? We'll come real quickly. We need to be on the floor. It's probably you do too.
I do. Hopefully my staff is asked to have an excuse. Madam Chair, I did discuss with you last night. I don't think a sunset would be appropriate if we remove the word maintain, but given the questions of the word maintain, it was actually John Powell's suggestion when he indicated that both Providence and Blue Cross could live with the word maintain, that we could put a sunset in to try it for 2 calendar years, at which point we would have the claims data and be able to come back and revisit and see if there was a substantially increased cost and weigh that against the benefit to children. And I also just wanted to point out for the record that insurance companies have in their booklets denial and exclusions for children with these disabilities over the age of 7. They're written in black and white in the policy books. This is the experience of many, many families across the state, some of whom put their kids in foster care for this very reason. So for them, they are not making this up. It is a very real problem, mm-hmm. and this will provide services that they currently are not able
and
to
Representative
have.
And some plants do not have that exclusion.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not common. I'm sure it occurs.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yes.
We don't like testifying these kind of bills.
Well, I know. These are they are important, but they're also emotional. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2918, and we will continue this, carry it on over till tomorrow. Okay. And Representative Gelser, you're tasked.
Adjourned.
Oh, I know.